This is an ABC podcast. This is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, this is Angus Furley. Coming up on the Country Hour today, there was some big news on Friday for dairy farmers who are still waiting for money from Murray Goulburn. You'll hear from Chairman John Spark. And lobby group New South Wales Farmers has slammed the Victorian government's move to make pain relief mandatory for mulesing as of this Wednesday, saying it's hypocritical and amounts to virtue signalling. We'd like to hear from you. Should pain relief be used? Should its use be mandatory? You can text in on 0467 842 722. First up, though, farmer groups around the country are today calling for an ACCC inquiry into the poultry industry, modelled on the 2017 dairy inquiry, to investigate processor behaviour. The chicken industry is dominated by two major processors, which means that in some parts of the country, growers have no choice who they can sell to. Tony Maher is chief executive of the National Farmers Federation. He says grower complaints need to be investigated.
Look, there has been for some time some issues that we have been concerned about and poultry farmers have been concerned about. That's around potential, you know, misuse of market power and, you know, unfair bargaining and unfair practices and, you know, awareness and pressure that's sort of been put on growers and the relationship ultimately between processors and growers in the chicken growing industry.
So is it a case of a lack of competition?
Well, look, that's one of the things that we want to have a look at. There's clearly, you know, a small number of large processors and a large number of small growers. So any time you get that scenario, you know, there's potentially things that can go not as intended and potentially, again, have some implications, negative implications for growers.
So is there a power imbalance then where all the power sits with the processors and the growers really have no say?
Well, that's what we want the ACCC, and that's what we're really keen for the ACCC to have a look at, is the potential competition and unfair trading issues. And the initial review that the ACCC announced will hopefully shed some light on that. So, you know, we're very aware that growers are under pressure, increasing costs and reducing returns. So we want the ACCC to have a look at it and see what's going on there and address any issues should they find any.
Contracts that are in place between processors and growers, have there been cases of processors varying those contracts, not abiding by the terms?
Look, there's a range of scenarios. I've seen the contracts and they are incredibly complex, and it's a very difficult and challenging space to negotiate. So what we really want out of this process and what we want for a sustainable supply chain is for the growers to have confidence and trust and, you know, a real partnership across the supply chain. And again, what we want the ACCC is to look at is any unfair trading issues, any, you know, potential misuse of market power, look at the competition issues and just make sure that there is a sustainable and equitable relationship between growers and processors.
I have spoken with a grower in Victoria this morning who says that he'd like to see a mandatory code of conduct modelled on the code of conduct that's just been brought in for the dairy industry. Do you think that's the way it should go?
We've been talking about that for a little while, and that's certainly one of the options that we've got on the table. You know, a code of conduct that says this is how behaviour should operate, this is what the expectations are from each party in a relationship, and importantly, this is how any disputes or, you know, challenges that arise out of the contracts will be dealt with, because that's often the issue. If a grower does come up with an issue, they don't always feel empowered to have those conversations and seek, you know, remedies to any concerns that they might have. So a code of conduct, in our view, would certainly help in that regard.
Ultimately, though, Tony, is this going to do anything to actually improve the price that growers receive? Because we know that the chicken price has been stagnant for a very long time, growers saying that their margins are tighter than ever. Is a code of conduct actually going to change that at all?
Well, we hope it'll be one step towards. We're not thinking that this, you know, any code of conduct is going to be a panacea for all of the concerns in the industry. But what it will do is will hopefully set out the behaviours, expectations, conduct between key parties in the supply chain, and they are growers and processors in this instance. So, and hopefully we want growers to get, you know, a decent return, a fair return. We're not asking for anything other than fairness and equity across the supply chain, and, you know, for farmers to be able to invest and to get a return on that investment. We know that, you know, chicken growing has got large investment required, talking about sheds and, you know, payback return periods over a number of years. That's what we're looking for, is for people to have confidence to invest and for them to get a decent, fair return.
So as you've said, you want the ACCC to conduct an inquiry into the poultry meat industry. Have you had any communication from the ACCC about whether that's something they're likely to do?
Well, as I say, this is something that we've been talking to the ACCC about for a long time. And this initial review of the sector between July and December this year will be focusing on the trading relationships between processors and growers. So should it uncover and identify some real issues, then what we'd be seeking then is a full market study by the ACCC to look at the implications and the conduct and the relationships across the supply chain.
That was Tony Maher, Chief Executive of the National Farmers Federation.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Lobby group New South Wales Farmers says the Victorian government move to mandate pain relief during mulesing is hypocritical and amounts to virtue signalling. A number of industry groups have backed the move by Victoria. Wool Producers Australia wants to see other states follow suit. President of New South Wales Farmers, James Jackson, says making pain relief mandatory will add unnecessary red tape for farmers.
No, well, we're not certainly not supporting, you know, mandating it, you know, having some sort of regulatory instrument, you know, driving uptake of pain relief for mulesing. There's about 85, I think it's north of 85% of producers use pain relief for mulesing at the moment. So, you know, actually having a regulatory implement that you've got to, you know, essentially police and, you know, put resources into, we don't think that's particularly necessary. You know,
virtue, well, if it's widely...
It's virtue signalling by the Victorian government. And the Victorian animal welfare strategy, they've got to take a long, hard look at themselves, Josh. We see in Victoria, I mean, huge numbers of animals now have still got foot rot. They don't regulate foot rot, for instance. Now, foot rot's a disease where... you know, the animal's hooves fall off and they're walking around on, you know, bloody stumps. You know, it's quite painful. But
we'll come to the foot rot issue in a second, but James Jackson, just back on the mandatory pain relief for mulesing, if so much of the industry is already taking up 85 to 90% across the wool industry, why would it be such an impost on farmers to just declare it on your national wool declaration as they are filling it out anyway and encourage the remaining 10% to take up the pain relief option?
We don't have a problem with putting it on your vendor declaration. No problems. No problems with that. But, you know, so far as mandating it, you know, having a regulatory instrument, you've got to actually police, you know, you've got to have a mechanism to police these things. So, you know, do you spend, you know, huge amounts of resources, government resources, you know, policing something that's, you know, essentially widely being done already? We'll have a look at, you know, if the Victorians introduce it, I mean, we'll have a look at what they're doing and how they're regulating and the cost of the regulation. I mean, red tape for the sake of red tape is nonsense. It's rubbish.
Some wool producers are hoping that if you make it mandatory for mulesing, it could protect the practice of mulesing, which a lot of wool producers are hoping will be able to continue and be an option that's available to them as there's more and more pressure from animal welfare groups and consumers in Europe and elsewhere to end the practice.
Yes, there is pressure to end the practice, and this is where the bigger picture of actually what animal welfare means is the piece of the question or piece of the puzzle that actually has to be interrogated, Josh. Now, the Europeans are very reactive in their animal welfare you know, strategies, and Victoria is taking that approach as well. Now, the OIE definition of animal welfare is how an animal is coping with the environment in which it finds itself. And invasive procedures, although they're used by animal liberation groups quite aggressively, you know, to demonise animal agriculture, in the context of an animal's, you know, the welfare impost on an animal, they're a second-order issue. I mean, you know, the issues that are causing, you know, welfare impacts on sheep at the moment in Australia are, well, nutrition in the drought, and the guys manage that really, really well, you know, by selling them, by feeding them, by assessing them, and things like diseases. You know, the diseases, the foot rot, which is regulated in New South Wales, and there was 9 million sheep with virulent foot rot in 1990 in New South Wales. Now there's something like 400,000. That is a welfare triumph. Mark Pearson hasn't been interested in foot rot because he can't mobilise animal liberationists talking about foot rot. Foot rot is a bigger issue, a bigger impost on the welfare of sheep in Australia than mulesing.
That was President of New South Wales Farmers, James Jackson, ending that report from Josh Becker. And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think about Victoria's move to make pain relief for mulesing mandatory? Is it the right way to go? You can text in on 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
There was big news on Friday for dairy farmers who are still waiting for money from Murray Goulburn. A virtual meeting of unit trust shareholders was held online, and rural reporter Peter Somerville dialed in.
It almost sounds like a funeral, doesn't it? But it's actually what Murray Goulburn Unit Trust shareholders heard before an extraordinary general meeting, which was held online on Friday. It was the meeting that called in the liquidators and brought closer the end of the Murray Goulburn Group. The recommendations put to shareholders were carried, so what remains of the co-op will be wound up. Shareholders had five items to vote on. The least popular gained the approval of 99.12% of the shareholders, and that was after an address by Chairman John Sparks.
Today's meeting is the next step in the winding up of the company, which was contemplated in the extraordinary general meeting of shareholders held on the 5th of April 2018. At that meeting, 96% of shareholders voted in favour of the sale of the MG assets to Saputo Inc. Since that time, all of the significant legal issues have been finalised, and as outlined in the explanatory memorandum for the meeting, the company would ultimately wound up after resolution of the retained litigation.
Mr. Spark took questions from shareholders, including one pertaining to the remuneration of the liquidators.
Liquidators' fees will be charged on a time spent in the remuneration approval request attached to the notice of meeting. There is significant complexity in the overall MG corporate structure, which includes Murray Goulburn, also the MG Unit Trust, along with the Australian Financial Services Licence obligations, which have to be attended to. The liquidators will also be dealing with a significant number of shareholders and unit holders throughout the liquidation, particularly in relation to their tax position and their tax issues. The liquidators will also be responsible for managing the AIG litigation. The costs actually incurred in any winding up are specific to that winding up and the obligations of the entity which is being wound up.
And within half an hour, it was over.
Your directors will now step down from their controlling roles, and upon conclusion of this meeting, Mr. John Lindholm and Mr. George Georges of KPMG are charged with control of Murray Goulburn Cooperative Limited and its winding up and deregistration.
Now, within 3 to 4 months, shareholders will receive an interim distribution expected to be around 43 cents per share. There'll be a final distribution in 12 to 18 months' time before the Murray-Goulburn Unit Trust will be terminated and all companies in the Murray-Goulburn Group will be deregistered.
I now declare this extraordinary general meeting closed.
John Spark ending that report from Peter Somerville.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
Sheep studs are being encouraged to look into exporting genetics as a way of supplementing the loss of sales from COVID-19. Brittain Hazelwood, the new president of the Australian Stud Sheep Breeders Association, says the cancellation of many sheep shows this year has been a big blow for the industry. He's speaking here to Larissa Smith.
I would like to see the role of genetic potential that Australia's got in its stud sheep breeds being used more for export. I think there's a great export potential for our genetics, which would involve semen and embryos. There is certainly some trade out of Australia presently with both semen and embryos, but it's not very great. I know that there is potential for that to increase. It's not necessarily an easy job to do, and it would be nice if we could smooth it a little bit, so to speak, to make it easier to achieve that. You know, I took on the role in April, and of course the virus has hit us, and that has thrown a spanner in the works a little bit, because all the shows have been cancelled. You know, the biggest sheep show in Australia, the sheep show at Bendigo, has been cancelled, and virtually all the spring shows will be cancelled. So that has sort of thrown a spanner in the works. So the association is working to try and fill the void as best we can, so to speak, for our members, because the shows were a great get-together for stud sheep breeders, you know, great, other than showing your sheep, a great social event.
So do you think this will trigger further interest, as you said, in embryo exports with the British breeds? So what sort of regulation or red tape needs to be eased to improve that for producers?
Well, I think the first thing that really needs to be done is to determine where potential markets are at present potential markets, so we know what opportunities there are out there. That is not necessarily very easy to do. There's nothing like actually being in a country to know what their requirements are. Of course, travel is off the cards at the moment, so you can't do that. But communicating with sheep people in other countries, of course, can still be done, and that's a great way of doing it. It's then knowing what the requirements of the importing country are and how the Australian authorities can meet those requirements. Not only have your sheep got to meet those requirements, it's generally health issues, so there's a lot of tests involved, and then you've got to actually get the semen or embryos there to the importing country, and they've then got to be approved once they actually arrive there. So there's quite a few steps down the line that have got to happen, and it would be just nice to be able to, if people are interested in exporting genetics, to be able to give them a guide as to what is required, a step-by-step to help them. It won't necessarily be the definitive answer of what's got to happen, but it would give them some guide as to what is required.
You've had some experience in dealing with the US. Do you think that could be an avenue for further exports of Australian embryos?
Probably to a limited degree. We've certainly sent English Leicester semen to the US. We actually sent live sheep there 30 years ago, but that's off the cards now. I've sent semen there on two occasions, and embryos to Europe. Probably there's more potential in Europe than there perhaps is in America.
Brittain Hazelwood, president of the Australian Stud Sheep Breeders Association. A couple of texts have come through on our story about mandatory pain relief for mulesing, which is coming into effect in Victoria on Wednesday. Linton from Lake Marmal, he says that pain relief should be brought in mandatory nationwide, not just Victoria. It would show the world that we are serious about our sheep welfare. Also a text from Andy. He says that pain relief makes a big difference to lamb recovery, and if the industry wants any animal welfare credibility, it should be made mandatory. And also a text from Steve Harrison. He said on the point about whether it amounts to more red tape, he says that wool growers have already been audited for pain relief for mulesing for the past 10 years through the National Wool Declaration. There is no additional cost to wool growers, and there's no government people driving onto your property. You can text in on 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
The Western Victorian Ag College is getting a multi-million dollar facelift. Longrenong Agricultural College Principal John Goldsmith says it's welcome news and will help to continue to move the school into the tech space.
Oh, this is a fantastic announcement, Cherie. We've got $1.5 million which we used to upgrade our agribusiness centre. It's one of two main teaching areas at the college. There's a number of classrooms. There's a student resource centre, there's staff offices, and that was built in 1986. Coincidentally, it just happened to be when I was a second-year student at Wollongong College. And, yeah, it's going to be a complete refurbishment of those teaching spaces. And then the other $500,000 will be used for the construction of a standalone classroom. It's interesting, we've got to the stage where, you know, on Wednesdays where we have all our vetted school students here, we're actually starting to run out of classrooms. So that'll be a great addition.
Now, just thinking about agriculture and the different courses, what kind of trends are you seeing there amongst the students?
Our demand for our full-time courses remains pretty consistent. Our Advanced Diploma of Agribusiness Management is always popular, and that's our core offering. But so I guess the interesting trend we've seen this year is in the apprenticeship area, unprecedented demand. And that's there's that word, unprecedented. Certainly a huge spike in the number of students that have enrolled in the apprenticeship area. And I've been working at the college almost 30 years, and it's certainly the highest number of apprentices I've seen during that time.
And what kind of courses are the students looking at there?
So in the apprenticeship area, you know, Certificate 2, 3 and 4, you've got a huge number of Certificate 3 apprentices. So these are students who are working on farms, and they come to the college for their trade blocks. You know, the Cert 3 group, for example, come in six times a year and get a lot of that theory and the management-based stuff, which supports the practical training they're doing on the job. So these guys, well, depending on whether they're from a cropping or a mixed enterprise, now obviously a lot in northwest Victoria, they're based on cropping enterprises, so they're actually selling crops. So we do a lot of machinery training with them. We've had students here this week who've been doing front-end loader training, for example. Look, they'll do their farm chemical course, we'll do first aid training, we'll do OH&S training with them, all the way through to shearing sheep for those that are on mixed enterprises.
And looking at the mix there, you're seeing more females entering the industry?
That's a trend we've seen for quite a while. Our full-time student cohort at Longy in 2020 is exactly 50% male, 50% female.
Okay, and how many students do you have?
Yeah, so our full-timers is just under 100, 100 about our capacity, just over 100 our capacity.
And just thinking further about the pot of cash that you'll be receiving from the state government, in terms of technology, ag tech, in terms of that space, will you be looking at AI or virtual reality or that kind of thing at all?
Well, we've actually got a project that we've been working on for a bit over 12 months now. Again, with state government funding, we were very fortunate to be allocated $2.5 million last year to develop a data farm here at the college. And we've been working on that for just over a year now. And so we've purchased a whole range of new equipment, self-propelled boom spray, a new air set. We're nearing completion on a new innovation centre. It's got all the TV screens, and we'll be a bit like the old NCIS you see on the telly with all the touch screens. And we're about to deploy a whole range of sensors on our farm. So the Longy farm all of a sudden is going to become a technology showpiece.
Longrenong Agricultural College Principal John Goldsmith speaking with Cherie von Hirschner. Well, it's just about to go 12:30 on the Country Hour, so that means it is time for news headlines with Erin Somerville.
Good afternoon, Angus. Ambulance Victoria is urging Victorians to limit their travel around the state during the school holidays. It comes as Victoria today recorded an extra 75 new cases of the coronavirus. Paramedics will continue to wear personal protective equipment and decontaminate ambulances after every patient. More details are expected to be released today on how a new pre-approval process will work for Victorians travelling into South Australia. From Wednesday, people travelling across the border will need to apply for an exemption online as South Australia tightens its border restrictions. The Victorian government has cast doubt on plans to turn the Latrobe Valley coal mines into lakes. The government's mine rehabilitation strategy has found filling the mines using water from the Latrobe River may not be possible. The Victorian Resources Minister, Jacqueline Symes, says other water sources and options need to be considered. A former student of a girls' home in Ballarat says the Catholic Authority, the Sisters of Nazareth, signing up to the National Redress Scheme is a step in the right direction. The final report by the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse found there were 48 claims of child sexual abuse against the Sisters of Nazareth, which had five residential institutions. The religious order has submitted final documents to join the National Redress Scheme. The Mansfield Shire Council has adopted a new master plan for Lake Ilden to help turn it into a tourist destination and attract new business. The plan includes four business cases for potential development of the area, including eco-retreat accommodation overlooking the lake, increasing holiday construction, and the development of a boutique distillery. And the Major Gippsland Football and Netball League has decided to abandon its 2020 senior season due to COVID-19. Both the Gippsland League and the North Gippsland Football Netball League will focus instead on their junior competitions. The Gippsland League's junior football and netball competitions start on July the 18th. And for more news, you can visit our website, abc.net.au/news.
Thanks, Erin. Off to the Weather Bureau now, where Senior Forecaster Dean Stewart is on duty. Good afternoon, Dean.
Yeah, good afternoon, Angus.
Dean, certainly a frosty start to the day where I am in Horsham.
Yes, that was the case right across the state this morning, Angus, with all districts having some sub-zero temperatures. The coldest was actually at Mount Hotham Airport, but Strathbogie and Omeo both shared minus 4 degrees. Warrigal, Rutherglen and Yarram, but all around the minus 3 degree mark this morning. So particularly chilly in those spots, but as we said, chilly conditions right across the state. There has been some fog. In most areas it's cleared. The northeast valleys had a fair bit of fog earlier this morning and also down through Latrobe Valley. But one area it is hanging on, as has been the case in recent times, is around that Yark, Molesworth area where there is fairly thick fog, and it will take another couple of hours, I think, before it does eventually dissipate from those areas. The rest of the state is enjoying plenty of sunshine, quite light winds. They are just tending around to a light northeast to northerly across western parts of the state as we speak. Temperatures today, we're looking at them peaking mostly between 13 and 15 degrees, with Mildura expected to be the warmest, nudging 16 degrees this afternoon. It does look like the high pressure system, which is giving us the frosty mornings, will contract towards the Tasman Sea overnight tonight. And we're starting to see frontal systems. One's already passed across southern Western Australia. It'll be heading across the Bight towards Victoria. So the combination of those two features, I think in most areas of the state, there'll be a little breeze in overnight, which should prevent as widespread frost, although I think through parts of Gippsland it will still be pretty chilly with sub-zero temperatures down in that area. Once again, we're likely to see some fog patches reform overnight tonight. And then that first of the fronts I mentioned, it'll come reach far western border areas of Victoria around about 10 or 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. But what's happening in that first front is weakening and it's basically going to slide southeastwards down towards Tasmania. Nevertheless, we're likely to see a little bit more cloud come across the state with that front. And from that cloud, look, just a sprinkling of showers moving in from the west late morning and getting into central areas early afternoon. I think rainfall totals in a lot of cases will be barely enough to register in the gauges, but potentially we might see the odd fall up around a millimetre or two, and that's about it. Once that goes through, a second front will approach, but on Wednesday during the daylight hours, much of the state will be between the two fronts. So back to relatively sunny skies through parts of the state, particularly down through Gippsland and around the south central areas. But that second front will come into the west very late afternoon or maybe not until Wednesday evening. So some further showers coming in from the west late Wednesday, and they'll extend across the state overnight during Thursday. It does look like it will have a little bit more shower activity with that second front, particularly down through the southwest where we could see some falls of 5 to 10 millimetres, but generally elsewhere less than 5 millimetres. But fairly windy conditions developing, particularly around the ranges, the Great Dividing Range. We could get some quite strong wind gusts Wednesday night into early Thursday. Following that, there does look like there'll be another front coming through on Friday and possibly even another very weak one coming up on Saturday. So what it means is we'll keep some shower activity going, mainly through southern and mountain areas towards the latter part of the week. And Even right across the weekend, I think there'll still be some showers through southern districts. The north should see a return to fine conditions. And right through that period, those temperatures don't change too much. In the first half of the week, generally around the mid-teens mark, a little bit warmer on the Wednesday between those fronts, and then cooler conditions with that second front going through overnight Wednesday night into Thursday, Angus. So the worst of the frosty mornings is probably behind us, but it does look like being a little bit more showery, particularly through southern areas as the week progresses.
Okay, so plenty of shower activity later in the week, but not necessarily very big totals in at least those northern and western parts.
Yes, I think that's right. It will be cold enough after Wednesday that we will see some further snowfalls over the alpine areas as well. So that's good news for anyone wanting to do a bit of skiing over the school holidays. But for most other areas, as you say, not amounting to too much across northern areas.
Okay, thanks, Dean.
Thanks, Angus.
Dean Stewart there, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Proponents of a proposal to deliver more water for agriculture in Gippsland had a big 24 hours late last week. First, the state government announced $500,000 for a study to scope potential development of further irrigation in the region. That was on Thursday night. And then on Friday, the Latrobe Valley Regional Rehabilitation Study was launched. According to the opposition, this document is the first sign of the government recognising that it won't be able to rehabilitate the Latrobe Valley's open-cut mines with water. To start, let's hear from the chair of the Latrobe River Irrigators Group, Angus Zilm.
We strongly feel that this study, which we will be heavily involved with, we are confident that it will deliver some positive results and identify that opportunities that we as irrigators and farmers on the Latrobe River are already aware of.
So there is this scoping study that we're talking about, but at the same time, a strategy document looking at how to rehabilitate the Latrobe Valley's coal mines has come out. It hasn't ruled out using water from the Latrobe River to fill in the big holes in the valley. Does that add up? Do those two things combined make you nervous at all?
Look, today I think was an excellent announcement from the LVRRS. It endorses everything that we've been raising our concerns about. It's a point of acknowledgement that they're heard. The announcement today from the LVRRS around the strategy that's the blueprint for how the mines are to be rehabilitated clearly says that further exploration is required for alternate water solutions such as recycled water and desalinated water. This is exactly what we've been campaigning for from the beginning, and our concerns are that there, with climate change, that stream flows are predicted to fall by up to 50% by 2050, and we are encouraging the state governments and the mine operators to explore alternate water sources, which is exactly what this report that's been announced has come out today and said. We acknowledge that water may be part of the solution for rehabilitating the mine voids, but we're concerned that with climate change, there is potentially not enough water in the Blue Rock and Latrobe River system alone to completely rehabilitate the mine. I mean, they require 3,000 gigalitres of water, which is six times the size of Sydney Harbour. It's a phenomenal amount of water. And we are encouraging them for a project that is taking 60 years to complete, that they look at alternate different sources of water.
I'm no expert, but I'd assume that recycled water or desalinated water would be a lot more expensive than opening the floodgates on the river and letting it go into the mine. Do you think that will happen?
Yes, I strongly think that it will happen. We're talking about a project that's going to take 60 years. If we're thinking about state-owned infrastructure that's going to build either a new desalination plant, which could be used to shandy with water from the Blue Rock catchment, or a pipeline from Melbourne's wastewater or treated water from Melbourne, which is currently in the vicinity of about 50 gigalitres per year that runs straight out into the ocean. Projects like that are capital infrastructure, which is good for the area. It's good for the mine rehabilitation project because it's another water source. It's good for irrigators because it frees up this precious resource, which will create jobs and opportunities for irrigators along the Latrobe River.
Nationals member for Gippsland South, Danny O'Brien, has welcomed the scoping study and says there's a chance to create opportunities for farmers.
Well, I've always said that I think we should be looking to double the size of the McAllister Irrigation District and not double the production, but looking at quadrupling or quintupling or more the production out of that area. Not in its own sake, but to create jobs and to create opportunities for farmers and people right throughout our region. And I think there is an opportunity for us to do that. Now, whether it is literally doubling the size of the MID, perhaps not, but certainly there are opportunities for us with this water. Now, whether that's for existing growers, for the dairy industry, for the horticulture sector or others. And what I'd really like to see is the opportunities for more protected agriculture in Gippsland, more greenhouses and glasshouses, which is the really high-value stuff.
The government's response doesn't rule out taking water from the Latrobe River to fill the mines. However, Minister Jacqueline Symes says the impact on communities and water users will be front of mind.
Rehabilitation is a very complex area, and for too long I think people just got along with things and not having to hopefully put too much effort into the considerations that are available. But we know we've got to a point where there is an end life on these mines, and rehabilitation is something that the community want to be engaged in, want to have the conversations. I know agricultural sector irrigators are concerned about their access to water, but I want to give them the confidence that this future work of rehabilitation certainly has at front of mind the impact on the community and other water users and the like, and assessing the feasibility of alternative water sources is something that is a joint responsibility, and we want to work with industry and the community on exploring all opportunities that benefit the region.
Minister for Agriculture and Resources, Jacqueline Symes, ending that report from Peter Somerville.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
The Victorian Health Department is urging owners of backyard chooks to observe safe handling practices following a surge in salmonella infections in people who had contact with chickens or ate eggs from household flocks. Most of the cases are from households across Melbourne's western and northern suburbs, with cases also in Gippsland and western Victoria. Deputy Chief Health Officer Dr. Angie Bone spoke to Jane McNaughton about how salmonella enteritis poisoning can be avoided.
Since we've had, you know, a number of cases now of Salmonella enteritidis, and some of them have been linked to backyard chickens, and my main message really is just to make sure that when you're handling chickens, you're doing it in a way that is hygienic. So it's really, really important that people wash their hands after they've touched chickens, or they've been in a coop, or they've handled the litter or feed. That's one of the main things, and also making sure that kids do that too, because we know how much, you know, kids love touching the chickens, playing with them, but it's really important that they wash their hands afterwards, and that they need to be supervised when they're around the chickens, and perhaps not, you know, cuddling and kissing and letting them touch their face too much, because obviously if the salmonella gets into their mouths, then they can get a gastro illness, which can be pretty nasty in some instances.
Salmonella's not a new disease, but do you think people are aware that it's not just eating or touching raw chicken, it's actually alive on the animal as well?
I think it's quite possible that people don't know that. It's not that usual for us to have outbreaks linked to backyard chickens. There are a number of diseases that you can get from animals, and it's always really important to make sure that you maintain good hygiene when you're in contact with animals.
There was a bit of a spike in people wanting to live sustainably out of their own backyards when the COVID-19 restrictions came into place. That also came with people stockpiling chickens. Do you think that that's got something to do with this outbreak?
I have wondered that. It is certainly true that people are kind of trying to get the simpler life, for example, and having backyard chickens could be one of those things. And I would add that I have just noticed that in the US, they also have some salmonella outbreaks linked to backyard chickens. So I'm asking myself if there is a sort of a change in the way we're living our lives that perhaps is putting us more into contact with chickens, and therefore that's why we're seeing more salmonella.
You mentioned about the physical handling of the chickens, but another element that comes with having backyard chooks is you might get some eggs. What's your advice to people who are consuming eggs out of their own backyard?
Yes, that's absolutely right. It's really important to handle those eggs well as well. And what's special about this particular type of salmonella is that it gets into the egg before it's laid, whereas other salmonellas get onto the outside of the egg as the egg is laid. So, you know, with contamination from the stool, essentially the poo of the chicken. But this is kind of deep inside the egg. So that's why cooking your eggs for Salmonella enteritidis becomes more important, because just by cleaning the outside of the shell, you can't get rid of it. And, you know, I understand that people like runny eggs. They like things made with raw eggs, like, cookie dough or mayonnaise. But all I would say is, you know, recognise the risk. And if you are particularly vulnerable to having an infection, so very young children or older adults or people who already have some problems with their immune system, they're the people I would say, please be very careful about the way you're cooking, storing and handling your eggs. And all the basic advice about eggs also still applies. So you shouldn't use cracked or damaged or heavily soiled eggs. Try and clean them with a cloth, but don't wash them, because that sometimes puts salmonella on the outside into the egg. And keep your eggs in the fridge if you can, because that will mean that they will keep for a little bit longer.
And what are some of the symptoms that people should be looking out for? When do you know that it's a bigger problem than just having gastro or diarrhea?
I think the main differential is that with salmonella, you can sometimes get a fever as well as, you know, the abdominal pain and the nausea and the vomiting. And it lasts a little bit longer. So it might not start for 48, 72 hours after your exposure, but then it does tend to linger. It goes on for 4 to 7 days. So it's not like just one of those 24-hour viral things. It goes on and you feel pretty rough. If you're really, you know, becoming seriously unwell, you know, you're fainting, you're in a lot of pain, you're not really being able to keep any fluids down, or you're in one of these vulnerable groups, I would suggest either calling your doctor, or if it's looking very serious, then obviously, you know, treating it as an emergency and calling 000.
Outside of just general hygiene and cooking the egg, is there any other links to why this salmonella outbreak might have happened?
I think that we certainly know that there was a problem with Salmonella enteritidis last year. There was a farm in Victoria, and I know there was a problem in New South Wales. And we thought that it was pretty much under control, and then it has re-emerged now. We're still trying to investigate what the likely cause is. And all of the we have 9 cases now of Salmonella enteritidis in humans, and we don't yet have any sort of common link or common source between them. There is one case that has a sort of indirect link with a commercial farm. And what sounds like it's happened is that, hens that were spent at the end of their egg-laying life, normally they go off for processing into animal food or what have you. But it does sound like a few of these chickens went to somebody who then had them at home. So we're still exploring all of this to understand better, but it is possible that there might be some links with one commercial farm. Our colleagues in agriculture are working very closely with that farm. The farm is under quarantine and there are no eggs from that farm in the marketplace.
Victoria's Deputy Chief Health Officer Dr. Angie Bone speaking with Jane McNaughton. And staying on egg safety now, one farm near Geelong says it's cracked the code and can eliminate bacterial growth in eggs by smoking them. Julie Koss and her husband Paul from the Smoked Egg Company say through clinical testing, they've found the smoking process essentially stops the eggs from ageing and increases their shelf life to as long as 5 months. As an added bonus, the taste of the product is also enhanced as a smoky flavour is infused into the egg through the pores of the shell.
Paul got the egg and took it into the smoker, and when we got back, he actually said to me, "What are you going to do with it?" I said, "I'm going to make quiche." He said to me, "I hate quiche." I said, "Well, I don't care. Bad luck." When he brought the smoked egg back and I actually cooked with it, we found that it had the most amazing flavour. It was incredible.
It actually was good. It tasted really good. It's mellow. It's a mellow, smoky flavour. People describe it as being like bacon and eggs, but without the bacon.
So then we realised that the marriage between the actual egg and the smoking process was quite incredible. Being an Italian family and also having a daughter-in-law that was vegetarian, we asked them all to come over and wanted to show them, maybe we were onto something or maybe we just thought we were onto something. And particularly Caitlin said, "This is amazing for vegetarians. This is incredible. So nice to be able to have an egg with a different flavour." And it changed every recipe that we cooked the smoked egg with. You had a totally different recipe or product. Sometimes you get a stronger hit than others, and it really depends on the size of the egg as to how much flavour you get in the egg. Sometimes we can't control the natural pores in an egg, so sometimes the flavour isn't as strong, but most times you get a really good strong flavour for poaching, frying and scrambling.
And as far as the actual operation of the farm goes, Paul, how many chooks do you run at the moment?
We run 5,000, and that's full, so it's a big job.
Free-range operation?
Free-range operation.
So do you use your own eggs in the smoking process when you sell them?
No, we don't. Cozzy's free-range eggs actually have a beautiful creamy flavour, and that flavour gets masked by the smoke. So we actually do, and we can't keep up with the demand, so we actually buy the eggs in for the smoking process.
And how many eggs can you smoke at a time at your factory?
We can smoke about 75,000 eggs at a time. That's with the one smoking unit. But we don't have to buy another smoking unit. We just add more chambers to the smoker, and we will be able to do about 250,000 eggs at any one time once we're in full production. What we found is when we were actually testing for the egg, we found that the egg white wasn't breaking down. And over the course of, we thought maybe by leaving the egg sit for 5 or 6 or 10 weeks that the smoke would infuse more, which wasn't the case. And what we come up with, as we were doing it, I was saying to Paul, "This egg's not breaking down." So at that point, I said, "Maybe we need to start doing some tests." So we started doing some tests, and we had a control egg, and then we had a smoked egg, and we got from 1 to 4 weeks, or 3 weeks, and there was no difference. Then we went to week 8, the normal egg had 21 million bacteria, and the smoked egg had nothing, and that was kept at ambient temperature. So what we actually found, it was a precise equation of time, temperature, humidity, volume of smoke versus volume of product, and that's how we actually worked out the smoking process. I think the fact that we've got a safe egg for pregnant women, young children, or people that are ill should be eating bacteria-free foods, and now we've got Nature's Own vitamin capsule that is bacteria-free. So we're really quite excited about what we've achieved. Finally, we're starting to get people understanding what we're doing, because people just did not understand. They heard the word smoked and they thought it was a boiled egg.
Boiled egg.
And which it wasn't. It's still raw. Mm.
Since it's raw, what kind of food can you make from it?
Anything that you can cook a normal egg with. Like today for lunch, we've had carbonara, smoked egg carbonara. Also had a tartare with the smoked yolk. and also a smoked lemon meringue pie, which was really, really nice.
The smoky flavour of the eggs is praised by chefs at some of Melbourne's high-end restaurants, and the shelf life of the product is applauded too. Chef Johnny DiFrancesco has incorporated the smoked eggs into his menu at Grandi.
So the reason why I use smoked eggs is because of obviously the technology that's being used. The egg is so much safer to use. So the shelf life on it is so much longer. But also the uniqueness of the flavour. You can't get that through even just trying to smoke a dish. So once you implement a smoked egg into the dish, and it could be across various dishes, you just get this flavour that is indescribable.
That was Chef Johnny DiFrancesco from Grandi Restaurants in Melbourne speaking with Jane McNaughton. And to find out more about smoked raw eggs or Victoria's recent salmonella spike, you can go to the ABC Rural website. Time for one more text from Andrew at Edenhope on using pain relief when mulesing. He says that pain relief should be a no-brainer for lambs at marking, whether it be mulesing or otherwise. Wool is not produced in the abstract. It has to have a market, and the market is increasingly sensitive about animal welfare. First principle remains, keep your market happy or you will lose it. And he says pain relief is cost effective, however you look at it. And that does mean it's time to get off to the market, starting today at Pakenham with Brendan Fletcher.
G'day Angus, numbers decreased to 1180, that's 130 fewer with the usual buyers all competing in a dearer market. Quality declined with fewer prime lots and more secondary cattle on offer. Well-finished trade cattle lifted 10 to 20 cents on most sales, grown steers and bullocks improved 15 to 20, manufacturing steers sold firm, cows sold firm to slightly easier, with processors loading cows for an estimated 575 to 628 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls lifted 20 cents. Vealers 340 to 463, yearling trades steers 372 to 448, heifers to the trade 350 to 441, grown steers 380 to 413, bullocks 382 to 406, heavy Friesian steers 320 to 332, crossbreds 320 to 380, most light and medium weight cows 227 to 300, heavyweights 262 to 340, heavy bulls 312 to 322. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan, and now to Wagga Cattle with Leanne Dax.
Numbers jumped up by 460, with agents yarding just over 2,500. Quality was fair, with a mix of secondary yearlings in genuine store condition, trade and heavy cattle in reasonable supply. However, trade cattle sold to much softer trends than the previous week. Too few veal to quote, 386 to 420. Trade steers were back 25, 380 to 420. Feeder steers softened 3 to 5, 390 to 435. Restocking steers, 280 to 330 kilo, averaged $1,417. Feeder heifers were firm to 4 easier, 365 to 410. Trade heifers were back 13, 368 to 416. Grown steers and bullocks firm to 3 better, 360 to 410. Heavy cows gained 10 cents, 295 to 347. There were too few leaner cows to quote to the processors, most going back to the paddock at 277 to 360. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Bendigo Lambs now with Jenny Kelly.
Good afternoon. Smaller yarding of 9,000 lambs, 3,000 less, couldn't save Bendigo from a price crunch of $10 to $20 per head as the market followed the cheaper trend seen late last week. Two major exporters didn't field buyers, and the rest of the buying group were selective and operating at reduced levels. Big export lambs up around 38 kilos carcass sold to $266, with most sales of heavy lambs over 30 kilos from $220 to $250 to average 700 cents over an average run. The 26 to 30 kilo crossbred lambs, 186 to 225 to average $215, and the 24 to 26 kilos from 181 to 215 to average $202. The sweet domestic lambs, around 20 to 22 kilos, held their value the best at 176 to 205. Just 2,800 sheep also lost $10 to $20. Good runs of Shawn Merino Weathers, 160 to $200 at 600 cents a kilo. Huge crossbred used to 225. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks, Jenny. And finally today to Mortlake Cattle with Chris Agnew.
Thanks, Angus. Agents yarded 707 cattle at Mortlake today, a slight increase on last week's sale. The offering was excellent for grown steers and trade cattle. The offering of cows was more mixed, with less beef bred cows on offer. All the major operators and processors were active in a market that was firm to dearer in places. Grown steers and heifers were firm to the trade. Trade cattle were 10 cents stronger. Cows were firm. From the limited number of milk fillers on offer, these made between 380 and 420, yielding steers to the trade 380 to 422, with a heifer portion 375 to 410, feeders paying to 422. The grown steers 385 to a top of 413, with the grown heifers 295 to 388. The heavy beef bred cows 295 to 322. The medium weights 240 to 295. The very well covered dairy cows 240 to 285. Cows back to the paddock selling to 264, and grown bulls beef bred to 283. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. Well, that's almost it for the Country Hour today. Thanks for all your texts. Some pretty strong support for using pain relief when mulesing. Remember, you can jump on the ABC website, abc.net.au/rural, for more stories from all over the country. Newstime, 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.